Identification MPSM 17, continuation of interview with Bill Ford. This is tape two, side A.
But if you have a look at other areas on the waterfront, finally there isn't enough area for all the people you need. Say by the time when commerce grows in the 1950s to where you have very large numbers of waterside workers, you finally have to find other places. That was one of the connections with Bronte, was that you had when the Bradfield Highway was built, the first major restructuring of the rocks in many ways is to bring Argyle cut through there to allow them to. The second one is at the turn of the century to get Hickson Road through, and the third one is to take the top, literally the entire top off the rocks to put the Bradfield Highway in. Now those people were literally taken and dumped in Clovelly, and Clovelly became known as Poverty Point. And so if you talk enormous numbers of the old residents of Clovelly have a connection with the rocks. They were just taken off.
They were taken out when they were building the bridge.
Basically Bradfield Highway.
They approached the bridge. Okay.
That was it. You see, you didn't need it at this here because there wasn't a great deal there. But you had to take the whole top off the rocks to put Bradfield Highway. So it was the approach, the southern approach to the bridge.
So what year did you move out of Miller's Point to Spring Street?
1940.
1940, okay. And but your Auntie Margaret stayed on at the old house.
Yes, and there was a period when Dad moved in as caretaker and Mum wouldn't move from Miller's Point.
Why do you think that was?
Oh, well, she knew. That's what was her community. The idea of moving into the city, we lived in what now would be classed as the penthouse, but in those days it was a caretaker's flat. And in many ways it was a lonely existence. I continued to go to Fort Street Primary School, and I continued to be part of the sort of Miller's Point community. I think that was one of the differences between myself and my brother and sister, that they hadn't established themselves there, and so they grew up somewhat differently. I used to every evening take Dad's dinner. I would, from Miller's Point, I would walk to Spring Street with Dad's dinner every night.
From Miller's Point, when he was living there in Spring Street, right.
Yes.
Yeah. And then you moved in, and when you left Fort Street Primary, the boys and girls were dispersed to different schools.
Yes, Shirley went to Dover Heights. I went to Cleveland Street Intermediate, which is in Redfern. Others went to Enmore. I find it interesting, apparently the kids from the Rocks now go to Balmain. We always came south or east rather than west. I don't know when that actually changed. But one of the interesting things about being at Miller's Point was at Fort Street, and indicated perhaps the economy of the time, is that we had a football team and we played Plunkett Street, which was Woolloomooloo, and in the under 5-stone-7 school championships. And when we played Plunkett Street, we played in the Domain, and so large numbers of the unemployed would turn up for the game. And it was really quite incredible, a number of sort of coaches and everything, that none of us knew much about what we're doing. And we never had enough football jumpers for more than the back line of the team. I remember I inherited a football jumper from my cousin Jack, which is Shirley's elder brother, and he was able to get one because of the SP booking. But I never ever wore it in a football game because I was too slow to be a back, and so I had to give my jumper to someone else. And I remember we travelled to Gardiner's Road, which is out Mascot, to play one of the semi-finals, and even the teacher didn't know how to get to Gardiner's Road. I mean, we were totally lost. As a group of kids, we'd never been to that part of the world. We got the wrong trams, and we eventually got there, but I'm not certain how. And I can never work out how we come to play in the grand final, because we were beaten in the final. So it wasn't many decades later I worked out that we must have been the minor premiers, and therefore had this right to go back into the grand final. And we went to Redfern to play Redfern in the grand final. And there were bookmakers at the game. We're the under 5 stone 7 kids. And I remember we got thoroughly thrashed that day. I think we were a bit overawed by the sort of stepping into that sort of world. But most of us never went on as football because there was no playing fields in our part of the world. And I remember it's one of those strange memories you have. We're walking with one of our teachers one day, and I'm not sure whether it was to get the tram to go to one of these events, but he made the point that he'd been to university, and none of us had a clue or had any interest what he was talking about. And it always stuck in my mind. I mean, none of us had any notions of going to a university. Of course, that's what a lot of sort of queer people were anyway. So, and in fact, when I was first offered a scholarship to go to university many, many years later, I told them what I thought they could do with that, because I wasn't going to go to one of those strange sort of places. So there was no notion of coming out of that world of a notion of higher education.
Just before we go there, I'm just curious about your uncle with the who lost the leg. How did he survive economically?
He survived as a winch driver on the wharves. He was a casual winch driver. His son Ronnie used to tell me how he'd have to go and pick up his father's pay, because it was hard enough for his father to get to the job when it was available. And quite often he had to go somewhere else to get paid, and so Ronnie would always go and get his pay. But he was a winch driver. That's the person who, ran the cranes on the ships.
They're really putting on the noise in Bronte today. We've got the helicopter, and then we've got next door the big renovations. just so people understand the background noise on the tape. You went to school to Cleveland Street Intermediate, and you were saying that it was just taken for granted that everybody left school around 15, and you did too.
Some people who went to Cleveland Street later went on to Sydney Boys High. My brother did that. But there was opportunities for lots of jobs when I was 15, and so I went and got a job.
So that would have been just when the war was coming to an end.
Yes, it was the beginning of 1945. And I got a job with Riverson Meat Company, which was in the meat exporting area, and I worked in on the edge of Darling Harbour Railway Station, and mainly I delivered bills, picked up bills of lading or delivered bills of lading to various wharves, and so I was actually perfectly trained for that job, because I knew every wharf, I knew every street, so no one ever had to tell me how to get to a place, I was given tram tickets to go there, but I invariably jumped on the back of the trucks and went there.
Bills of loading, are they the things that accompanied the...
The shipments, yeah. The shipments. You were shipping meat. one of the fascinating things about them, they were still done in old colonial terms. You had inward and outward, that is, we didn't ship things to England, it was an inward shipping. This is the colonial centre is London.
London. And the spokes around it.
And outward bill of lading was something coming out of London. You had to go and pick up something. And then an inward bill of lading was inward back to the... And this was the classical colonial trade. And we practiced the same thing with Papua New Guinea and Fiji. It was the way the colonial system worked, and that's why many of the colonies developed very narrow concepts of commerce. It was you supplied what the mother country wanted in the system. My first. My first experience of sort of other cultures was that when we had to supply a ship with a Muslim crew with meat, I would have to go to Redfern, where there was an old camel driver, an Afghan camel driver lived, and he used to have to put his marking on it to show that the meat had been killed in and satisfactory for Muslims. And I would go out to Redfern quite often a little bit of fear, I think. And I'd knock on this door and I'd go in and here were these old retired Afghan camel drivers who were used in the Northern Territory smoking their Hubbly Bubblies. And it looked like something out of those old Charlie Chan movies that we used to go and see made by Hollywood, where all these kind of strange people from other worlds, and all he do would do with a crop, and I could have put a cross on the thing. I mean, these people were totally illiterate, and they just put a cross on it to indicate that it was, and they of course had no idea that the meat was killed somewhere else. I learned very quickly some of the cultures of the waterfront. The first day I was sent across to the goods yard. They were unloading pigs, porkers, they were called porkers, big porkers, for to be taken off the rail tracks on and delivered to either a ship or to a freezer area. And my job was to count them coming off. And I remember saying the first truckie, "You got 25. And he said, no, you can't count, kid. I've got 24. I said, "No, you've got 25. He said, "Listen, kid, you better learn to count in this area." And one of them was a freebie, which would be delivered to a friendly butcher shop somewhere. But I was in no position to sort of argue.
Did you find it a tough place to be as a young fella?
No, it was a place I think that my recognition as a scholar is as much to do with growing up there than it is for all the sort of formal learning I did. I learnt about a culture from the bottom up. I didn't learn as a sort of middle class kid looking down at it.
You learnt about the interaction of function and people and what actually worked.
And I came to work one day and one of the truckies said, "I won a trucking company at a two-up game the weekend." Right. And it was real. He won a company in a two-up game. So he was now the proprietor. And I don't think he was literate at all. And so he went into the chief clerk and the chief clerk said, "Well, you're now the proprietor." You know, the chief clerk was kind of educated. He was the owner of this. I think there were three trucks in the thing. He won a two-up game. And then he said, "Well, now I can go buy myself a motorbike," and he said, "I can go riding in these at these motorbike races at the showground." And he said, "I need a sidecar person. So you'll come, won't you?" And I said, you're joking, I'm going to get, you know, sit in a sidecar and, you know, and those were one of the big sport attractions at the time. And he said, get the back of the bike, we'll go for a run around the waterfront. Well, I remember at one stage he tried to go between two trucks, and I had my elbows on each side of the truck, and sort of the bike had gone, you know. And I said, there was no way. I mean, so you met all sorts of people. And it was part of learning how the commerce of the world operates at that level. I mean, the wharves are in terrible condition, and you ask, why are they in the terrible condition? Well, the Maritime Services Board was, previously the Sydney Harbour Trust, was politically corrupt organisation. The politicians used it to appoint people to boards and all sorts of things. And when I was a scholar once, I went down the Maritime Services Board to ask for the plans for the Sydney waterfront that I wanted to study it. And I was given the cold shoulder so brutally, you know. And I asked one of the ship owners why. And he said, oh, they still haven't got up to date on their 1926 plans. They said, they're not going to let someone like you have a look at them.
And there were awful awful accidents where people slipped on, we've got these in the oral history, slipped on a bit of wax or grease and fell down a hold and maybe broke their back or, you know, and there was no such thing as compensation in those days.
No, well, first of all, the wharves were a dangerous place. You worked in the rain, and they would put these huge rain canvases over, but you worked in the rain. And I remember going onto one wharf, this was when I was later in the 1960s when I was studying the wharves, when there were planks were missing in it, and it was a dreadful wharf. I see, and the wharfies refused to work on this wharf. It was one of the wharves in Darling Harbour, and the wharfies were penalised for not working there, not the company, the Maritime Services Board, for having an unsafe wharf. And I said to one of the ship owners, "Well, why don't you complain about this?" He said, "Oh, the Maritime Services Board had fined me for bringing your ship down the harbour sideways." It was an area that where the camaraderie was amongst the people who lived and worked there, and they had to, and that was part of the survival.
Because one of the things that you haven't mentioned when growing up in Miller's Point is politics. Was that not something that people got passionate about?
Yes. Well, first of all, the waterfront was basically a very strong communist area, but the local politics was strongly ALP, Australian Labor Party.
In Miller's Point?
Miller's Point, very strong. If you have a look at the two memorial halls in Miller's Point, there's one to Harry Jensen Hall. Do you know these two halls that are here on the base of here? They're at the back of St. Bridget School. There's the Harry Jensen Memorial Hall here, and there's the Albert Moss Memorial Hall. These are the two community halls. Now, Harry Jensen was an electrician, a contract electrician, when I worked at the oil refinery in the late 1940s and early 1950s. He became mayor of Randwick and became one of the most famous mayors of Sydney. And of course, this is part of the city of Sydney. And then Albie Mott, was the local ALP boss in the area when I grew up. And Albie always said to me, "Bill, you will inherit my empire," because I never quite did. But Albie, and he was, I never, as a young kid, understood the power and influence of people like Albie. And I never knew what I was supposed to inherit, you know. But somehow he designated me as someone that would eventually.
Were your parents strong Labor people?
They were Labor people, but they weren't strong. In any election, I never worked in this area at all because it was no good to me. Labor was always going to win it. I would go out and work at a swing electorate. I remember going out and working for Dr. Everett when he first became leader of the party in 51 or 52 or something like that. Dad, following his experience in World War One, really effective. He didn't want to join any RSL type organisations. All those sort of organisations he just wanted to stay out. He'd had enough conflict in his life. It was very clear that he didn't. One of the things that I still have trouble with is talking at a dinner table. We were taught that food was hard to come by, so nobody talked at a dinner table. We were not allowed, strictly nobody. You got whacked over the head if you weren't there just eating. My mum or dad never sat down and had a meal with us. Mum cooked and they ate after us. The kids, were to be seen and not heard. And we were never allowed to talk religion or politics in the house. The religious argument. One is pretty clear, five generations of a mixed marriage. You can't afford to have too many violent discussions in those areas. I think Dad had had conflict.
That was it.
Yeah. And it was hard enough surviving without getting involved in too much other stuff.
So just moving along from the beginning in the meat exporting business, you mentioned you did various other jobs like Lowe's, but oil refinery, where was that?
Let me run through them. As the waterfront, there was always a belief in our house that the end of the 1940s would be like the 1920s. That is, you won the war but lost the peace, we'd move into difficult employment times, and there was no notion that the end of the war would mean prosperity. The waterside area was an area of protection for jobs. So anyone who joined up from the waterfront had a right to come back to that job. So it was pretty clear to me that waterfront jobs were going to be scarcer and scarcer. I'd done 2 years as a messenger boy on the waterfront, and I decided it was about time I moved on. So I got a job at Australian Window Glass out at Alexandria, again as a junior in those days, which meant I did all sorts of things. I was a payroll assistant. At the age of 17, on the days that the payroll would arrive in the big truck for this factory of four, I would sit there and with a whole group of other people and put the monies into the envelope. You had all the money right to the last penny in it, and then the paymaster would walk around the factory and hand out, and I would walk with him with a gun. I had never been taught to handle a gun. I've never taught to fire a gun. I was never taught to, in any sense. I would take all the bullets out and then put the safety catch on the gun, and the bullets would be in one pocket, the gun would be in the other. So there was no way in the world I was ever going to use that gun. But every Friday I would wander the factory with this gun.
And you were only about, 19?
Oh, no, I was only 17. 17. And then I decided that I was, the glassworks was run by, was part of Australian Consolidated Industries, and it was been built up by a man called Knockout Smith, who that's the way he did business, and he built up this giant empire. But the empire became so much run by a family, and the tradition of the third generation finally destroying it. We've seen that happen with each of Grace Brothers, David Jones, Waltons, all of those. When I was working at the Window Glass, we had a general manager whose brother was the marketing manager. He was absolutely stark bombing, hopeless. And there was no job there of any promotion that you got if you weren't a relative. And I remember talking to the foreman one day, and I said, "How'd you get this job as a storeman, a chief storeman?" And he said, "Oh, I married so and so, kind of the chief engineer for the entire ACI, which was the third largest business in Australia, was an incompetent fitter who'd married one of Knockout's daughters." So I decided that it's about time I left the glassworks after about 18 months or so. And I got a job with W.C. Douglas, Rich Red Fountain Brand Tomato Sauce and Sweet Fruit Chutney. And understanding of incompetent managers came when the boss called me in one day and said, "I notice you're finishing that job in about half an hour every day. I employed you to do that job for 8 hours. It's an 8-hour job, and you've got to do that job for 8 hours, right?" I said, "But I finished it. I've got the whole thing is absolutely finished in half an hour. I do the day's work in half an hour." And he said, "Well, you better get lost for the rest of the time. I don't want to see you." So I used to wander the factory learning about all sorts of throwing tomatoes and I suddenly realised that there was not much future in that business. So they were starting a new oil refinery out at Bunurong. And I forget somehow a connection I had there. I got a job in the new, when they were just finishing the construction out there. And I went into production as the sort of human kind of numbers man. At that stage, they didn't have computers. So I'd carried out every calculation on the refinery every day with a Swedish calculator machine where you pulled a handle and thousands of wheels turned. And so I crunched this machine every day. So where people sit in front of a computer at 9 o'clock every morning, I had to give the figures of production to the a customs man, or he would shut down the refinery, or and because I was a production person, it meant on overtime I could work on any overtime jobs going. So I used to work on the drum rolling line as a drum roller. I'd work as a painter on painting the big tanks. And then the boss one day said to me, "Look, I want to put you on shift work. And you don't have enough basic education to be a shift worker in an oil refinery. I want you to go down to tech and find out how to get some basic education, like do the leaving certificate." So I got in the tram and I went down to tech, and I had absolutely no idea how a vocational guidance system worked. Although I have recollections of trying to get an adult apprenticeship at one stage and getting knocked back because I'd turned 17, and those days, if you're over 16, you couldn't get an apprenticeship. And so I went into Sydney Technical College on Broadway, their vocational guidance unit, and sat there for an hour or something. And a little fat man came back in, and he said, "You're still sitting there?" And I said, "Yeah, how's the bloody place work? You know, I can't work out what, boss sent me down here, and he said, he'd been out having his evening drink, preparing for people like me that come in at this time every year who've got, no idea. And he said, what are you here for?" I said, "Well, the boss said to get enough education to be a shift worker. And I reckon I'd like to get enough education so I don't have to be a shift worker." And there was no other. And he said, "All right, well, will you do some tests?" And so I came back on it. And I got, remember getting home late for dinner, for my mum was worried, where have you been, you know, kind of, you know. And I said, I was down at the tech. And then I said to her, I've got to go back tomorrow night too, and I've got to do some tests, you know. And I did these vocational tests. And I came back the next week, and he says, what do you do? And I said, oh, I work at the oil refinery. I'm a pretty good drum roller, you know. And he said, he said, well, all your tests except one are above the level we would expect for a second year university. And I said, and he said, look, we've got an adult matriculation program that was developed for CRTS, which was the Commonwealth Reconstruction Training Scheme, to train ex-servicemen who wanted to go on further with their education. And these were currently the people from the Korean War were starting to come back. And he said, well, you know, I can get you a place on that if you... So I thought about it, and my brother Frank had gone to Sydney Boys High and was doing a leaving certificate that year. And I said, well, if I'm going to do the leaving certificate, I may as well do it the year my brother does it, and I get some help, you know. Again, there was nothing more to it than... So I said to Mum, okay, I have £100 in the bank. I'll take it out and buy you a washing machine. And that's for the rent for as long as I go off on this tack, you know. So I went out, and she didn't want a washing machine. Of course, she said they don't make your clothes clean. You know, she was going to use the old boiler. I bought the washing machine and went into and said to the boss, I'm quitting. And he said, you can't quit. He said, you know, and again, no notion of quit. He said, in a few years' time, you'll have three or four people working on these same machines and you'll be the boss. You'll be the boss of three or four people, you know, doing all these calculations for the refinery. And I said, yes. So then I had to choose subjects, and I had 7 months to do, well, effectively on some of them, the entire high school work. I had 7 months to do maths. So when I enrolled, I committed some dreadful faux pas. I mean, when the person that was enrolling me was, I didn't know, the modern history teacher, and now I know he was clearly, he'd been living with his mother all his life, he was clearly gay, and when he suggested I should do history, I said, oh, that's for poofters, you know, I'm not going to do something like that, you know, and he said, well, there are a limited number of subjects you can do, he said, because, you know, you've only got, you know, it's now March, and the leaving certificate is going to be in October, November, so, you know, you can't do any science subjects because you can't do the practical books and all those sort of things. So he enrolled me, I needed 5 subjects to matriculate. He enrolled me in 6. So I could drop one early when I didn't like it or something. So, and it turned out to be a whole lot of subjects which I didn't have a clue about. I mean, I did English, general maths, modern history, ancient history, geography and economics. I had absolutely no idea what economics was about. And then I went along to the first class. What I find that at this stage we've got the first wave of Asian students coming in. And they have to get their local qualification. And so after about a week, I realised that there is one really good English teacher. And they decide to split the class into 2, the English class, one Asian and one for the locals. And most of the locals were, in fact, people who were repeating the higher school certificate to get into a particular area they needed, or they were doing 1 or 2 subjects that they'd failed and needed that for their job or something. And it wasn't, the CRTS has in fact started to phase out, and it became part of the general secondary education system, but mainly for adults. And so they said, well, splitting the Chinese students will be in that room. That the first time the Chinese students meet, I go to the Chinese. And I mean, Rusty Moore, as the teacher, said, I'm sorry, Bill, this is for the Chinese. I said, Rusty, I've worked out that you're the best English teacher. And as far as you're concerned, for the whole of this year, I'm Chinese. I'm here. And I did that on every, sometimes when people would come late for class, particularly some girls who would seem to be there for reasons that their parents needed to have them at school or something, they would come in late. It was a sort of, they'd been out somewhere. And one of the teachers would say, get them, would someone get them a chair? They were sort of, you know, might not have a chair. I'd say, they can get their own bloody chairs if they come late. They can go and get their chairs. So I ran it like a shop steward. And in maths, we had a little Swiss maths teacher. And he said, well, because you all have done maths, he said, we'll do first year maths in the first week, second year maths in the second week, third year maths in the third week, and then we'll start major fourth year maths, and then we'll go on into fifth year maths later on. So the first 3 weeks will be just for revised, the first, right, none of this. And so he said, so he puts up a whole board of algebra, and he said, now does anyone not understand that? And I said, yes. What don't you understand? I said, the whole bloody lot. What are you doing, adding apples? You know, and he looked at me and said, like, no, it's A plus A is 2A. I said, but they can't, that's the letter of the alphabet. Are they apples or they're not, you know? And he's saying, no. And he could see that he had this aggressive, who really, I mean, I had absolutely no idea about, and so I realised I had to do 5 year maths in 7 months, and it was...
And you did it.
Yeah. And then halfway through the year, they had an internal education department exam for people who failed one subject in the leaving certificate because they were short of primary school teachers, and so they had a sort of sneak entry into Enmore Teachers College. So you bring a group in the middle of the year to keep on. So I heard about this, and I'd never sat for a public exam in my life, so I better find out how you do a public exam. And so I went down there and said, I want to do this mid-year. They called it mid-year leaving. And he said, well, what subject do you want to do? I said, I want to do these six subjects. So he said, no, sorry, you can't do six subjects. I said, why? He said, well, if people just come down, one or two, no one ever does more than one or two. And I said, well, I'm coming down to the six. And he said, but that means you're going to be doing it on, I think it was Thursday morning, Thursday afternoon, Friday morning, Friday afternoon, Monday morning. I said, yeah, I mean, I need some practice, you know. And so I get down there, and of course, fortunately I did. And because, I mean, you have the sort of people supervising these exams, and I was asking them questions. What does psychology mean? You know, what are they talking about? You're not allowed to ask questions. So what happened was that all of a sudden I get a letter from the education department saying you passed all six subjects. We're offering you a scholarship to a 2 year scholarship to Enmore. Of course, the teachers at Tech said, you can't accept it, you can't, you know, because, you know, it means it's not a recognised exam, and so you'll never be qualified to go to university. Not supposed to go to university, you know, but by this stage I decided that I actually did want to be a physical education teacher and maybe teach in the playgrounds and things like that. I was going to also live a life out in the open. So they taught me to not taking the scholarship, which would have been put me into a dead-end primary school system for that. Then coming up the leaving certificate, I went down to the education department, to the physical education department, and said, I want to know what sort of result I got to get if I'm going to get a physical education scholarship. And they said, you're going to have to do honours. It's now, you know, it's a, you know. And I said, well, I can't do honours. I mean, I'm, you know, I'm an external student, and it's a month to go to the exams or something. So I went back, and I said to this bloke, I'd the history teacher, and I said, you want me to do honours? He said, well, I'll coach you between the pass and the honours exam. And so then I went to one of the other teachers and said, the geography teacher, and said, you know, and he said, well, I'll coach you between. So I finally sat for eight subjects. Instead of dropping one and doing five, I finished up with six. And I think I got fourth in the state in the history, the top 10 in economics. I got second class honours in geography, and I missed out by a perfect. I only got a B in general maths. So I went back to the Ori Foundry because I couldn't get a job, a little job. And the boss said, you only got a B in general maths, you know. So then he gave me my summer job back. And then when they offered me a job to go to university, they gave me a scholarship. I told them to stick it up their butt because, you know, I wasn't going to, you know, I didn't do all this hard work just to, you know, go to university. I wanted to get phys ed, and you won't give me a phys ed scholarship. But I was about to punch the bloke in the nose. They said, look, the reason we didn't give you a scholarship to do phys ed, you'd be bored witless with it. He said, and so I said, all right. So I went back to tech and saw the little fat bloke, Bill Bentley, and he said, how'd you do? I said, well, I got this in a minute. Yeah. What are you going to do? I said, well, they're trying to force me to go to university. You know, and I said, oh. And he said, how about giving it 1 year for a try? I said, all right. And the first year was, I played sport, so, you know, represented the university in water polo, basketball, and
this is the swimming. University of Sydney.
Yeah. Mm. And at the end of the year, I suddenly realised I had a good year, and I better try and get another year out of it. And so it went on like that, I guess.
End of MPSM 17 Side A. Start of MPSM 17 Side B.
And how did you cope with the absence of income, though? But you weren't bringing in anything to the family.
Yeah, well, I gave them. I bought Mum a washing. I worked out what my board was throughout for the year, and took out all my savings and bought a washing machine.
So you had built up your credit.
I built up. I paid my board a year in advance, and then I went back to the oil refinery and a good summer job. I worked overtime, and then got a scholarship, which helped me through that year, and then I got a scholarship to Wesley College which is a college within the university, which gave me accommodation for the next 4 years. And then I kept on living. I lived on scholarships then for almost 10 years. I got the Johnson Foundation Fellowship for Australia and Asia, which paid for me at the University of Illinois, and I got a Fulbright scholarship which paid my travels. Then I moved to the University of California. I got a research assistant's job and worked my way through university. And at summer, I worked as a tour guide in the 11 western states for Greyhound.
And you started off doing history, and then what made you shift into geography?
I actually finally did history honours, but I was always going to go back, in a sense, to study the problems of the waterfront. I mean, that was it. And so I argued for a position in industrial. I went to the Institute of Industrial Relations at the University of Illinois to study industrial life. Which I did, and then I moved to California and did that again. And while I was in the States, I was also very intent on learning about the the grassroots culture. That's why I went to the University of Illinois. I'd been offered Princeton University, but I didn't want to sort of...
So Illinois being more industrial.
Yeah.
Being more... Yeah.
So I did a lot of field work there in factories and started learning industrial sociology, industrial psychology, industrial economics. And then went to California and did the same. And while I was at the University of Illinois, I became president of International Student Cooperative. So I was basically a white president in a black house. It allowed me to really get totally involved in the black communities.
Just coming back to the Australian waterfront, when did you come back with this incredible body of knowledge and education and start applying it back here?
In 62.
And just describe that for me. What exactly did you do?
That was a year of a very difficult year for me. I'd come back to the staff of the University of New South Wales, and basically that was a technical university. They had the library was the fifth floor of the chemistry building, so I had to. And 3 years of studying industrial stuff in the United States hadn't really prepared me for what had happened in the 3 years I'd been away from my own country. And I was intent on not kind of doing like so many scholars do, just come back and start teaching what they'd learned in America. So I had to become deeply involved again in understanding what was going on in Australia, and realising that industrial Australia now had this massive wave of migrants that had come in. So I started doing studies at Leyland Motors, in shoe factories and things like that to understand what had happened to industrial Australia since I left. And I pioneered the study of migrant labour in Australia when it was not in favour. In fact, the government were outrightly against me doing it. When I applied for some research grants, I was totally blocked because they didn't want me looking at the underbelly of that. If you were studying migrants in Australia, you could easily get a grant for studying why British migrants went home. You couldn't get any studies for why Italian or Greek migrants, what were their problems in the workplace.
So they were considered to be a sort of an underclass who should know their place.
There was no problem there. There was a real problem that the government could see in British migrants going home. But there were no problems with all those Italians and Greeks. And
they were just wogs.
Yeah, they were no problems, and they were all leading a new good life, and they were now very happy, that was all bullshit. There were real problems in industrial Australia. In studying Leyland Motors, we found that many workers couldn't tell the difference between a trade union and a credit union. And so when they left, they went to leave the job, they'd go to the trade union to get their money back. Or when a trade union official stood up in front of them, they regarded him as someone from the credit union. What in the hell's he's got? He's got nothing to do with us, you know.
And they also had political baggage that would have affected how they viewed trade unions.
Oh, enormous amount. And there was a lot of machinations within the trade union movement of getting certain groups of migrants to side to vote for you. So the left and right were both involved in organising migrant votes. And if you had a strike meeting, and I would attend strike meetings, how can the workforce, which is particularly in the construction industry, enormous variety of languages, understand when an Australian gets up there and starts talking about the arbitration system and the judges? I mean, all the, not only don't understand the language, but they don't understand any of the institutional arrangements. And if you get up there and put on a migrant speaker, you have absolutely no idea what he's telling them. And it was very clear a number of the strike meetings I went. I couldn't understand the language, but I could understand the response to the migrants. He was saying something totally different to the union leader.
But just to try and make the connection back, it's such an interesting story that you leave the working class boy, you know, from Miller's Point. When did you come back and come into contact with actual waterside workers? And I'm wondering, what changes were you able to facilitate, or what sort of insights were you able to bring?
Well, when I came home, one of the first things I did was to go to the Maritime Services Board and try and get plans for what was happening in the waterfront, and that I was totally blocked. Mm. You know, they were, and I said, "Listen, I'm not from the Kremlin. I'm not trying to, sort of spy." And so there was an attempt by the traditional bureaucratic system to block me out of coming back and studying and being involved in the waterfront. And in fact, there was a Royal Commission on at the time on technological change set up by the government. And the Royal Commissioner made it known, not publicly, he couldn't do it, but privately, that I would not be invited as a witness because I would be more trouble than it helped. Of course, he came out with a huge report which said absolutely nothing. Yet there were some clear issues that had to be dealt with as you shift to bulk loading, as you shift to a whole lot of technological systems. That's when I started to do a lot of work on, well, in America I did a lot of work on retraining, relocation of people, all these sorts of things, that how does a working class cope with change. So I did that at the University of Illinois. I went out and interviewed workers who, and I remember saying to my work, "Can I look at your glasses?" And they're interesting. And I just looked at them. They were so scratched, there was absolutely no way he could have been reading the stuff that I was asking him to read. He was working on a lathe, and these were just pitted to all hell. And that it was clear that any notion of a traditional interview, which I was instructed to do, was ridiculous. I'd ask him to read something and then give me an answer to it. And it was very clear that looking at him, I mean,
And this, obviously, you were informed by the practicality of your early years where you would have known this was happening.
Yeah.
Did that give you more credibility with the workers down in the waterfront?
Oh, yeah, but it didn't give me much credibility in academic world, because I was told, I was refused promotion a number of times because it was about time I, learnt that, when I came back, I had a number of things I wanted to do. First and foremost, when I arrived at the University of Illinois, I found that every building had been modified for handicapped students. Every building in a university with over 200 buildings. And I went through this enormous guilt period of saying, the University of Sydney, where I went for 5 years, has no building modified for handicapped workers. Or handicapped students, and I made no attempt. And I had a fellow student in history who had gone through polio, like my wife, right? And I never asked him what were the problems of coping with it. It just struck me day one at the university, and I see all these students in wheelchairs and everything. Had access to every building, elevators, everything was designed for this. So I came back and I said that one of the first things I'm going to fight for is access to the handicapped. I come back to a university, we've got our own Dr. Strangelove is vice chancellor. He's more interested in atomic bombs and building concrete monstrosities at the university. He starts building a library that has no handicapped access, and so I start following him around his public meetings when he's doing public pontificating about the wonderful university he's building, and I start asking him about access to handicap. And of course, he wants to export me anywhere he can get rid of me.
And that was something you followed through on at the Opera House too, the disability access. But would have been later, and they still didn't have it.
That's right. I mean, we've been very... I was chairman of the state's employment committee and we held our first meeting in a building in Sydney that didn't have access to the handicapped, unless you took the handicapped people into the basement and took them up from the basement through one set of lifts into another set of lifts. And I just said, this is appalling. This is a modern building in the city of Sydney. It was still being built like this. So that was a kind of number one. Secondly, I'd gone into, I became very deeply involved in the black movement in America. And I went into Jackson, Mississippi with the Freedom Riders. I didn't go in as an active member because I was a Fulbright scholar and I was working closely with the Congress on Racial Equality at the time, and it would have been confusing problematic for me to be identified as a Fulbright scholar. But I went in and went into the courtrooms and went all through the thing without going to jail. I learned how to stay out of jail. So when I came home, I became deeply involved in establishing the first three Freedom Rides in Australia, and that's written up in
Anne Curthoy's
book. So if you read the first few chapters of that, you'll see that I'm the one that's finally recognised as the instigator of that sort of activity. Thirdly, I came back with a determination to set up a trade union education program like that I'd seen in run by universities in all over the United States. And I was rebuffed.
What's that, to educate people about trade unions?
No, to educate the union officials. I mean, they were to provide basic education on economic issues.
So that they could take a more informed role.
Yeah, yeah. And there was marvellous education programs in America, run by American scholars. They were recognised at the University of California. You had a management education program, you had a labour education program. Now, this was totally unheard of, and I was told by the university, by the head of my department, that, you know, if I don't stop all these other activities and be a good academic and start writing papers, there's not much future. And I didn't come back to be an academic. So I just continued on my merry way. The first lecture I gave to a class that included my future wife, I used the university as an example of an unfeeling kind of bureaucracy type thing. And she was horrified. You get sacked, She's going around with a bloke who, obviously has a very difficult notion of tenure. But she got used to the fact that, I was always going to rock the boat.
And that whole area of unfeeling bureaucracy, that sort of translated into the organisational groups that you went on to do, and how the relationships and how knowledge should be shared instead of hoarded.
Then I became terribly interested in going back to the technological change issue. And looking at, what are the consequences of technological change? It means that a whole lot of people do not have the skills to participate adequately in this new world. And I'd seen how retraining was a totally inadequate answer, because you can't just take a person off an abattoirs and retrain to be a commercial butcher. The culture is so different. I mean, I've studied both, and give you an example in America was when they were shutting down the meat packing houses in Chicago and moving them 2,000 miles to the west out to Nebraska and these are where the cattle really were by now. They said, okay, we'll have a big retraining program, and there was no lack of goodwill. It was a genuine retraining program. But what happened? They were going to retrain these abattoir workers to be retail butchers. Well, first of all, retail butchering was dying in America. It's totally dead now. At our three of our new relatives came out from America for my youngest daughter's wedding earlier this year. And what was the most interesting thing they saw in Australia? A retail butcher shop. They'd never, these three kids had grown up in America, had never seen a butcher shop.
It's all in the supermarkets.
Yeah. It's all packaged. Everything is packaged food. And here is a butcher who's cutting things, and you know, they were absolutely fascinated by this. So this huge program is going to train these people to go into retail butchering. And first of all, we're retraining them for a dying occupation. Secondly, if you're working on an abattoir line, you know the language of the line is another culture. It's an all-male, big, beefy culture. Blood shooting everywhere. You can hit an animal at a certain spot, and blood will shoot. So if someone's coming through, like the manager who you don't think's a nice guy, all of a sudden a shoot of blood will go that way on his new suit. And they all wear these white coats to make certain they, and the language is different, and the blokes who work on the technology are focused on the technology, not on the people. So the first group of retrainees go to a retail butcher shop, and I remember going to butchers with my mother, and she would instruct the butcher meticulously, no, that's got too much fat on it. You cut that fat off there, you're not gonna weigh that fat. I want that one over there on you. And she would have a dialogue with this bloke. And so these blokes learn to filter that out. That's part of your apprenticeship in a retail butcher. This bloke comes in, and a little old lady, just like my mother, comes in and starts instructing this bloke. And within seconds, he's back on the production line. He's suggesting things to this little old lady that she hasn't heard for many decades.
He's shouting at her.
No. Well, he's telling her to get,
knotted.
in strictly, with all the language of the line.
Right.
And so you realise that the retraining. So then we moved on to the notion of recurrent education, so that people and finally you have to move on to a notion of lifetime learning. But you can't have lifetime learning unless you've got learning organisations that are deeply involved. Because most people learn, particularly working class people, in their job. Yeah. They don't learn in institutional arrangements.
So they should be able to have access to learning on the job.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to stop you again and end of another tape, right. Bill.
End of MPSM 17 Side B. End of interview with Bill Ford and Siobhan McHugh.